I'm Jesse Thorne. This show, The Turnaround, where I go deep with some of the greatest interviewers in the world about how and why they do what they do. It's produced by MaximumFun.org, co-presented by the Columbia Journalism Review. My guest this week is Larry King. You know who Larry King is. You could probably identify Larry King from like six pen strokes. All we'd have to do is suggest suspenders, right? He hosted Larry King Live for 25 years on CNN, and he interviewed everyone. I mean, really, everyone. Celebrities, surgeons, UFO experts, Richard Nixon. Here's the thing about Larry King. He is an in-the-moment guy, and he is never afraid to ask a question that might make him look dumb. In fact, he tells me that being dumb is one of his greatest assets.
My friend Herbie Cohen, who wrote You Can Negotiate Anything, we grew up together. He says to me, Larry, the secret of your success is you're dumb. And dumb is the great road to success because you're not afraid to say, I don't know. Tell me. Help me. That's a lot of my interviews.
I think that his willingness to be open like that comes significantly from the fact that for decades and decades and decades, he hosted hours of radio every day. So often he'd be talking to somebody that he genuinely knew nothing about.
We used to do a night where it was, who is the guest? They would not tell me who the guest is. And this guy would walk in, I've got to do a 2-hour interview, guy or woman. And all they have to do is tell me their name. And then I'd find out who they were and then ask them questions. I love that. Because the less I know, the better.
All right. I'm not going to keep teasing you. Let's go to Larry King's house and my conversation with the legend himself.
Well, Larry King, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's
great
to get to
talk to you.
So my first question was, when was the first time that you realized you were an interviewer? I know you always wanted to be a broadcaster.
Oh, since I was 5 years old, I wanted to be on the radio. I just wanted to be an announcer. I wanted to be anything. I wanted to talk into a microphone. I don't know why. I must have had a good voice pre-puberty because people kept telling me, you got to be on the radio. So I would imitate radio shows. I would listen to The Shadow, and then I would go into my bathroom. We were very poor in Brooklyn, and I would go, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. I was driven by the sounds. Still am. And I knocked around a while, didn't go to college. My father would die when I was very young. Worked at a bunch of odd jobs. Finally, went down to Miami. Broke in on a small station.
This is the part that I want to interject on, because one of the things that I'm interested in is, you grew up. You mentioned you were really poor in Brooklyn.
Very.
This couldn't be further from the entertainment industry, the radio industry, or whatever. So, what gave you the idea? Oh, I could actually do this.
Just by listening, imitating. It stroked something in me. That I was comfortable with it. Had I not done it, I would have been a stand-up comic. I love making people laugh. I do a lot of speaking. But I just wanted to be on the radio in any capacity. I thought eventually it would be sports, because I'm a sports freak, and I love all sports, and I love going to sports events. I broadcast Dolphin games, and I've done baseball, but I thought I'd be a sportscaster. Red Barber, the Dodger announcer, was one of my heroes. As was Arthur Godfrey, who I later worked with. But I went to Miami, got a job on a small station. I was a disc jockey for about a year and a half, playing records, doing news in the afternoon, sports broadcasts, $50 a week I was making. And there was a restaurant in Miami Beach called Pumpernick's, very popular restaurant. And their slow time of the day was 10 to 11 in the morning, because it wasn't breakfast, it wasn't lunch. And the owner of the restaurant used to listen to me in the morning, doing my morning show, but usually very funny, a lot of humor. And he said, would you like to do a radio show from my restaurant from 10 to 11 where I don't get crowds? We might build up some crowds. The station went for it because he paid the station. I got a little extra. So every day I'd finish my shift 6 to 9, drive up to Pumpernick's and do 10 to 11. And I would interview waiters, and there was no producer on the show. You know, people just call people up from the audience. And then one day, out of nowhere, Bobby Darin, great Bobby Darin, walked in. Mac the Knife was the number ones. And I interviewed him for an hour. And later we walked down the street, down Collins Avenue. And he said to me, you've interviewed before? I said, no, I just talked to regular people. He said, I think you ought to take this up seriously because you really have a knack. And then I interviewed Jimmy Hoffa and Danny Thomas. None of them were booked. They came into the restaurant. That show caught on. The Miami Herald wrote about it. And I became an interviewer. And then the show switched at night. We went to the Surfside Six boat. And television came along. And I did a local television show for years. And then the Mutual Network and CNN. And 60 years, May 1st.
Do you remember what you talked to Bobby Darin about?
Everything. From music, from the way he listened to background sounds, the way he used backup singers or not. I remember that the drummer, Dick West, was his arranger. And that I thought was strange because most drummers are not arrangers. But his drummer arranged Mac the Knife and So May by Somewhere Beyond the Sea. And later in life, I would talk to Kevin Spacey about Darin because he's a Darin freak. And he did a movie about Bobby Darin. What I went to was my innate curiosity. When I was a kid, I was curious about everything. And it's funny, as in retrospect, when we would go to Dodger games, all my friends wanted autographs at the end of the year. I never asked for an autograph. But I would walk with the players as they're going to their cars asking questions. Why'd you bunt? Why'd they do this in the third inning? Why'd you take this pitcher out? I was at Jackie Robinson's first game. I got to interview him twice later in life. But my curiosity is still insatiable. You don't want to sit next to me on an airplane. I drive people nuts because I'm always who, what, where, when, why. A lot of whys, short questions. I hate interviewers who don't ask questions but make statements.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think that one of the things about your interview style that's special is that you're a very modest interviewer. Like, you are not afraid to ask a simple question of what is this?
They're the best question. Because when you think, I watch some of these press conferences and the question takes longer than the answer and the people show off. There was no showing off, not an intellectual. A New Yorker did a piece on me, called it Street Questions. I'm a guy in the street. Hey, what are you doing? So when the Gulf War was on, and we would have guests on every night associated with that war, writers, politicians, generals, and I always asked the same question, what happened today? I wasn't there. You were there. You were covering it. What happened? That's the simplest question in the world. Why'd you do this? What happened? See, and then let them, they have the, I'm not, I don't know more law than a lawyer. I don't know more politics than a politician. I have opinions, but I've never run for office. I've never argued a case in front of a jury. I don't know more medicine than a doctor. I've never operated. I've never done science. I ask questions of scientists. I'm a layman. I'm a pure layman who's intensely curious. What I do have is a sense of pace. I know when something's going well. I know how to draw people out. But I don't think I could teach a course in it. I don't know that I have a method. I just know that I go to the basics. And from the basics, you learn a lot. And you can bring people out. One of the best examples I can give is my first interview with Frank Sinatra, who didn't do a lot of interviews, and Jackie Gleason got him for me. And his PR guy said to me, Frank doesn't do these things. He's doing it as a favor to Jackie Gleason. But one thing, do not bring up the kidnapping of his son. He doesn't want to talk about it. He will not talk about it. I said, well, that's fair. I don't have to bring it up. Okay. In the middle of the interview, we're really in touch. And I asked him, the thing with you and the press, is it overdone or have you been bum-wrapped? He says, well, it might have been overdone. But I've been bum-wrapped too. Take my son's kidnapping. He brought it up. I just was asking good questions. And that's the framework of which I like to work. I don't have to know a great deal about, in fact, my favorite guests are people I don't know at all. I like doing physicists, who I know nothing about physics. I like doing astronomers, because I don't know about the heavens, but I wonder about them. What is an astronomer, when he walks down the street and looks up, what does he think about?
Are you always listening for that little something that stands out, that little interesting bit that you can pull on a little?
Because the key of interviewing is listening. If you don't listen, you're not a good interviewer, because the answer could bring... So I hate interviewers who come with a long list of prepared questions. Because they're going to depend on going from the fourth question to the fifth question without listening to the answer of the fourth question, because they're concentrating on what they're going to ask for the fifth. And that's not the way it works for me. So I concentrate solely on the answer, and I trust my instincts to come up with questions. Even if the answer fully answered the question, I'm ready in my head to go somewhere with it. There's no dead air.
Do you get scared ever?
No. Only the first time I was on the air when I was playing records and I got scared and nervous, and they'd just given me a new name and I had my record ready to go, and all my life I've dreamed of this. And I turned on the mic and I turned down the record and nothing came out. And the general manager kicked open the door to the control room and said, this is a communications business, damn it, communicate. And I put on the mic and I said, my name is Larry King. That's the first time I've said that, because I've just been given that name because they thought my real name wasn't good enough. And I'm very nervous, but all my life I wanted to be in radio. And I dreamed of this moment and I've been scared. So for 2 minutes, you've been listening to a record go up and down and nothing coming out. So please bear with me. And I learned something that day, which later Arthur Godfrey would tell me. You learn... The whole secret of this business, the secret of what we're doing right now is there's no secret. Be yourself. Be yourself. Answer honestly. Be honest. Be upfront with the audience. You can never go wrong. So what I did that day, even though I wasn't thinking that way, if you were listening that day and I was reading a commercial and goofed or miscued a record, it's his first day. It's his first day. I told that story in Canada once, and the guy said to me, well, supposing you were walking down the hall at NBC. Someone grabbed you, sat you down, put some papers in front of you, and said, Tom Brokaw is sick, you're on. I would look at the camera and say, I was walking down the hall at NBC. Someone just grabbed me, handed me these papers, told me Tom Brokaw is sick, and I'm on. I would then, trust me, I've never anchored news. I'll do the best I can. Hey. It ain't brain surgery.
I mean, one of the things that was some of the best advice that I've ever gotten, and something that I've had a really hard time doing, you know, sort of a lifelong practice to try and do, is to sit comfortably in your own ignorance. Like, if you don't know about something and you're curious about it, your job is to ask about it.
Correct. I don't know is... It's a great statement. What do you mean by that? I don't know. I don't understand. Or sometimes the simplest questions, you learn so much. Just because they're things I wonder about.
Can you think of a really plain question that you asked in your career?
Maybe a pilot. And I said, when you're going down the runway, do you know it's going to take off? And he said, I never think about it. Yes, it will take off, but it may not stay up. an engine could go, birds could fly into the plane. But if I'm going 160 miles an hour down that runway, it has to take off. Now, it may take off for 5 feet and crash, but it will lift off the ground. But he never thinks about it. I had a diabetes specialist, a world specialist in diabetes. And I said to him, what does the word mean? He didn't know. I asked Joseph Teller, who invented the hydrogen bomb. Now, I know nothing about physics. Did you have to go to the test to know that the bomb would work? And he said, no. If the math works, the bomb will work. It's getting the math to work.
I mean, there's this thing in comedy improv, this premise of how you build a scene. And it is that you walk into the scene, you listen and are open to what happens with your scene partner. And the premise of the scene is drawn from the first distinctive moment. The first time something happens that catches your attention, the first time something happens that's unusual, that first left turn, even if it's something small, even if someone says, oh, there's too many carrots in here, then what that scene is about is there's too many carrots in here. And it seems to me like one of the things that you're describing is, you know, being open enough to see when someone says something that's that interesting and recognizing it.
Of course. That's listening, and it's going to the moment. I go to the moment, and I don't cloud anything. If a sound, if something drops in the studio, I will refer to the dropping in the studio. If there's a fire over there, I'll tell the audience there's a fire over there. In other words, my friend Herbie Cohen, who wrote You Can Negotiate Anything, we grew up together. He says to me, Larry, the secret of your success is you're dumb. And dumb is the great road to success because you're not afraid to say, I don't know. Tell me. Help me. That's a lot of my interviews. Help me with that. You're a brain surgeon. You got brain surgery tomorrow morning. Think about it tonight. When you go in, do you check your hands if they're steady? Why do you want to be a brain surgeon? What about the intricacy of brain surgeons? The things I've learned are unbelievable. A lot of dentists are people who failed brain surgery. Same thing, except it's not death-defying. Working in small areas with a little instrument. So I take all that to life, and a lot of that I lead into when I do comedy, because when I tell stories, the telling of a joke is to set up the joke, know the pace, deliver the line. When I had my heart surgery, I had six bypasses, and my doctor, Dr. Wayne Isom in New York, famous heart surgeon, he did Walter Cronkite, he did David Letterman. He had a front page story in the New York Times about him and his work. And I'm in the week I was in the hospital, New York hospital, and I'm in bed and going home in a couple of days, and this other doctor walks in, and he said to me, I'm a brain surgeon. I have nothing against Dr. Isom. He's a fine heart surgeon. He said, but you know what a heart surgeon is? He's a plumber. They unhook and they hook up. They're plumbers. They don't have a wrench. They have another instrument, but it's the same thing. Unhook, hook up. Cut away the artery. I'm a brain surgeon. He says to me, one slip of the finger could take away your memory. I could cause you not to speak. One slip of my finger. And he gets the front page of the New York Times. And no one knows about me. And I said, because the song ain't I Left My Brain in San Francisco. Now, that was funny. Audiences laugh. And there's a truism to it. Because the heart, and then I'll go into discussions about the heart and the day I had the heart attack, make anything funny. I love interviewing comics. I have great times with comics. I love the way comics think. I like every great actor is smart.
Who that you've talked to was not what you expected?
A couple. Robert Mitchum, he one-worded me a lot, and I think he may have been a little drunk, but he was one-wording me. And I had the former, Bunky Knutson, the former president of General Motors, who did not know models of his cars that were coming out. He did not know about the Chevrolet Impala. What could he tell me about next year's Impala? President of General Motors, that shocked me.
When you're on live, and so much of what you've done is live,
even
live to tape.
Now, no, Larry King now is taped on Aura and Hulu. It's on the internet. I'm still doing what I've always done. I'm just delivered differently. But 90% of my life's work, 60 years, seven decades, has been live.
I mean, one of the things about being on the air live is that there's nothing to do but something. Like
That's wonderful.
You can't do nothing. You know what I mean?
See, tape is a safety ground that I don't want because I was born of the moment. I didn't know Bobby Darin was coming in. I liked that. We used to do on my radio show, I had the first national talk show. We used to do a night where it was, who is the guest? They would not tell me who the guest is. And this guy would walk in. I've got to do a two-hour interview. Guy or woman, and all they have to do is tell me their name. And then I'd find out who they were and then ask them questions. I love that. Because the less I know, the better. Now, that sounds strange to people. Like, if you wrote a book, I wouldn't read the book before I interviewed you because I would then know too much about the book. And I'm in the same boat as the audience. They haven't read the book. So we're all in this together. And together become a movement. Now, there's no such thing as the perfect interview. Yes, you could miss something. No one's ever done the perfect interview.
Well, let's wait until we're done with this and we'll see.
But I got you're getting there, Jess. But I had good early training, man. I'm 23 years old interviewing Eleanor Roosevelt. My God. Her son was mayor of Miami Beach.
Are you telling me that you weren't even nervous? I mean, I've been doing this.
First time I went to the White House, maybe a little nervous.
Yeah. When what about when Jackie there? Robinson walks in, when Frank Sinatra walks in?
By then I knew something.
The people that I loved when I was 14, that's who I'm afraid to talk to.
Okay. Why?
Because I don't know, because I was not even an adult then.
I'll tell you why, Jesse.
Yeah.
The simplest thing to do in that situation, I had a lot of it. I mean, I had a ton of it. Growing up to meet people because I was part of their age in a sense. So when I was 14, I was at Jackie Robinson's first game. You know, I attended Adlai Stevenson rallies when I was a kid. I interviewed Adlai Stevenson. And the way I would break the ice is right before I would just say, you know, Jackie, I was at your first game. I wouldn't do that on the air. I was at your first game and I've admired you so much. When I said that to Adlai Stevenson, he said, you're the first person I voted for. And I've admired you so much. And he says, we have just met, and I can tell you have a brilliant, brilliant mind and an excellent judge of character. He spoke with that clipped language. But so you make yourself comfortable by telling the person how you feel about them, how you admired them when you were a kid, what they meant in your life before you go on. Because when you go on, the show is not about you. The show is about them. You'll always be back the next day. It's your show. Your name is on the show. It was Larry King's show. I'm going to be there the next day, so I want Paul Newman to be very good and informative. So through me to the audience, I'm a conduit. And if I'm a good conduit, I'll be there the next day. So I want people to talk about Paul Newman.
How does this work when you're interviewing somebody that you don't like?
That's the hardest. You still have to do the best job you can. Sometimes you get confrontational. I've only got really confrontational with racists. When I landed in Miami, I took a train down to Miami to live with my uncle, and I had $14 in my pocket. And the first thing I saw was a colored water fountain. And I didn't understand that at all. It was a colored water fountain and a white water fountain. So I drank out of the colored water fountain. It was good. Then I got on a bus to go over to Miami Beach. And I sat in the back of the bus, and the bus driver stopped the bus. And he asked me to move forward because the back of the bus is for Negroes. And I remember I said to him, my father's a Negro, so I'm comfortable in the back of the bus, which was not true. But so I never understood racism. Why would the pigment of skin mean anything? Anything. So when I had George Wallace on early, or the head of the Ku Klux Klan, or George Lincoln Rockwell, the anti-Semitic races, I didn't. That blew my mind, and I would get confrontational and sometimes have arguments. It's not good to argue with the guest because it's maybe interesting for the audience, but it puts you out of control. When you argue, you're not in control. And I like to be. You're in control. And you're in control of this interview, Jesse, not me, you. This is your interview. You're in control. You could stop it. You could end it. You can go anywhere you want.
Yeah, I got to go.
Good. Goodbye. So what I mean is, so the hardest part is when you interview. Now, if it's not racist, but it's just theory, if I'm interviewing a conservative and I'm a liberal, then I totally respect them. And I try to ask the best questions I can for the other side, as I would do the same if I'm conservative interviewing a liberal. But it's only racism. If I deem you a racist, that drives me nuts. Drives me nuts. Because it's so ignorant. Ross Perot once explained to me the ignorance of racism. Ignorance. If you take a large body of your population, say you're Mississippi, it's 50% black, 60% black, and you educate them subpar, who's going to buy Buicks? Who's going to come up with new ideas in the defense plant? Why would you not educate? What are you afraid of? It's ignorant. So it's not only morally nuts, it's economically stupid. The South had to build two bathrooms when they only needed one. Two water fountains when they needed one. Insane. Insane. Over the pigment of skin. Boggles me.
One of the big things that happens in television interviewing particularly is the creation of emotional moments, right? And that's both true in a lot of cable news, live talking head type stuff. It's all built around emotional conflict. And in things like Oprah or Barbara Walters does, really brilliant television interviewers whose work is about getting to an emotional catharsis.
That's fine on the daytime when you're appealing at a certain kind of level. And we would have that at times. 9/11. God, it was emotional every night. I interviewed relatives of people who had just died. Went to the burn center and talked to people who've been burned. A domestic conflict is not one of my main. I don't like tabloids and who you're married to or who you're sleeping with. I'm just not. I'm curious from a standpoint of just that, but it's not. Doesn't bug my mind. But that has a place. They all have a place. A lot of cable news now, these interviewers aren't interviewers. They're statement makers. In other words, I make this statement and then see, do you agree or disagree? Then I make another statement. Do you agree or disagree? So the show is about them and not the guest. The guest is a prop. I never went on the air with an agenda. I never went on the air saying, boy, am I going to get this guy.
Why not?
I was there to learn. If you have an agenda, you're not going to learn, in my opinion. I don't learn anything when I watch shows in which the host and his guest are of one point of view, and that's the whole thing. You know, so whether it's Bill O'Reilly with an arch conservative or Rachel Maddow with an arch liberal, I don't learn anything. I know that Rachel Maddow stands for this and her guest stands for that, and they both agree. That's not a learning process to me. It's not a real Q&A. A real Q&A takes me, I'm interested in the heart of a person, how people react to things. What's it like to be a president and send someone to war? What's it like at night when you get a statistics, 132 killed today? How do you sleep?
You know, you're describing it as an exercise in curiosity, but is it partly an exercise in empathy and just wondering
that's
what
part
other people,
of it. Empathy,
what other
people's
lives are like?
Peter Ustinov, the great actor, told me he likes being interviewed because he gets to think about things he doesn't think about. I don't walk around thinking about things you've just asked me, but it forces me to think about them, and therefore I enjoy it. I like, as much as I like asking questions, I like being asked. If they're good questions, then it causes me to be thoughtful. I'm not a texter. I don't like texting. I like the sound of the human voice. I'm into voices. I like something about the inflections in a voice that you don't get in a transcript.
It seems like there's something about something I was talking with Errol Morris about, the way that people process themselves when they're talking, that sometimes things, one of the things that he said to me was that almost none of what has ended up in his movies or the best moments in his movies were the result of something that he asked. They were almost always the result of something that someone offered unexpectedly, because he was there and listening.
Yeah, but I think it had to be part of what he was asking. I think I wouldn't say that. I don't know. Because the whole thing was me asking questions. In the course of the questions, Sinatra said, take the kidnapping. That was an offering coming from a good question.
Right.
So I would say to Mr. Morris, you ask some good questions to get the thing coming. Because his thought process was still as a result of what you asked.
Did you really once ask Richard Nixon if he felt weird when he went past the Watergate?
I sure did. And I got a great answer.
What was the answer?
And it was funny. He said, I've never been in the Watergate. I don't look at the Watergate when we drive by it. Unfortunately, some of my friends have been in the Watergate. Now, I thought that was a great line. I interviewed Nixon quite a few times, and that was his funniest, I think.
Who do you feel like you talked to that you liked personally the most, that you least expected to like?
Oh, so many.
That you least expected to like? That I wouldn't expect that if I had a conversation with Nixon that we would have that much in common.
Nixon
I guess
was wonderful to talk to.
Bowling and baseball.
He had a brilliant didactic mind, Nixon. I would have never asked Nixon to solve problems, but I would have asked him how the problem got to be there. If I hired Nixon at a television station, he would be my analyst. If you asked Richard Nixon, tell me the origins of the Vietnam War, bang, 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 you'd have it. De Gaulle was in here, and he was in there, and this was the head of Vietnam, bang, 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 wouldn't have a solution. But boy, did he have comprehension. About sports, tremendous comprehension. But he was nervous, and he had problems with his own identity, and he lived in awe of the Kennedys, but he was a fascinating person to interview. I could have interviewed him all day, all day. He was never dull, and a lot of him shone out. A lot of him came out in his interviews. He was a fascinating character. When you said the interview of someone
that you least expected to like, that you liked the most.
That's easy. One of the Watergate burglars, the guy who wrote the book, put his hand on flames, went to prison, did a talk show.
Or G. Gordon Liddy?
G. Gordon Liddy. I was prepared to...
Good work, Jesse, by the way.
Very good, Jesse.
Before I was born, nailed it.
Before you were born?
Yeah, I was born in 1981. I'm just bald.
81?
Yeah.
I have ties older than you. 81. G. Gordon Liddy, I was prepared to despise. I read a lot about him and he was refreshingly honest. I just got to like him. He was so wacko. I mean, he was so wacko. I remember saying to him, did you say to Richard Nixon that if he wanted Jack Anderson, the writer, killed, you'd be happy to kill him? And he said, of course. I said, well, why? He said, he's my president. It's my country. My president regards him as an enemy. I'd give my life for my country. Of course I'd kill him. I said, well, Gordon, what if my president told me to kill you? Fair game. That's fair game. I mean, he was amazing. I wanted to hug him. You know, you could be that. But then when he was in prison, he helped a lot of prisoners. You know, he helped guys get out. He wrote briefs for them. My friend Herbie said it so well. Nobody thinks they're evil. Hitler did not get up in the morning, comb his hair, and say, I am a terrible person. Osama bin Laden did not look in the mirror and say, what a creep you are. Everybody's right. Everybody thinks they're right. And everybody has something. And what gets at me is what caused that tweak? Why did you go the way you went? I was asked, what would you have asked Osama bin Laden? You grew up in one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. Why'd you leave? Why'd you go to live in caves? It fascinates me. Why?
Stick around for more of my interview with Larry King after we find out about a few other great shows from MaximumFun.org.
Well, hoopity dop dop, scoopity dick dop, dibbity dabbity doobity habbity hoop. Hoopity doo doo, de pappity dee dee, de good doo ba da.
Whoopity doo doo,
a rabbity hey hey,
hoopity ha, it's a papa doo.
Baby. Do ba do 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 ba dick da da do 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 sida.
Stop podcasting yourself. We don't even know anymore.
Find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you download your podcasts.
Gates McFadden, Marina Sirtis,
Larissa Embitur,
LeVar Burton, Patrick Stewart look like movie stars.
Yeah.
Everybody else is like, you should just be on TV.
Sort of like when podcasters do this live.
Yeah.
Then the Greatest Generation is going back out on tour.
We're taking a new show out on tour about Star Trek First Contact. And whether or not you are a Star Trek fan, I think you're going to love this live show.
You come to our live show, you get Star Trek jokes. You get fart jokes. The whole gamut.
So come on out. It's bit.ly/ggtour2017. That's bit.ly/ggtour2017.
We're back. My guest is Larry King.
Do you think that the fact that you're Larry King affects the way that people react to you when you ask them questions?
It well might. Because when you get, Walter Cronkite told me that, when you get famous, it gets harder. You know, like he was at the, in 1960, he went to the Texas caucuses at the convention. As soon as he walked in the room, they all stopped, got autographs from him and stuff like that. It's not what it's supposed to be. So I guess that it's happened. Or people get a little intimidated at the thought of it, or they're thrilled to meet you, especially if when I interview like young rock stars, singers, or young people who have listened to me as children, and they come in like an, a little in awe. I put them at ease right away, usually with humor. I use humor a lot. Kid around a lot, tell them the latest joke I've heard. It's just, it's... I love telling jokes. I love jokes. Jokes are genius to me. Who? Cartoons. You read the New Yorker cartoon? Mm-hmm. They're genius. Genius. I mean, the guys who, they had a cartoon once of two guys up against the wall with nothing but loincloths on, handcuffed around the neck, the hands, and the feet. They're attached in the middle of a wall, attached to it, with nothing on, handcuffed at every part of their body, and one whispers to the other, now here's my plan. That's funny.
Is there something that you say when you are live and you haven't thought of something to say?
That is so rare. I'm telling you, that I don't know where that comes from. But my mind... seems to work. I never say things that a lot of interviewers say which annoy me.
Like
a lot of interviewers use the term, let me ask you this. Isn't that irrelevant?
Let me ask you this. Why is that a problem?
Because why do you have to say it? That's what you're there for. You're here to interview me. Of course you're going to let me ask you this. You know what I mean? That's silly. I was wondering. When an interviewer said, I was wondering, that's what you're here for, to wonder. So those are little things better not. Make a question a question. I love some of the sports interviews, the football coaches. You had a tough first half, and you got the boys in the locker room. In the second half, you came out, and you started throwing passes, and they clicked, and you won it. Yes. What's the question?
I've started, when I watch sports, if I see a sideline reporter who does a good job, I have actually tweeted at them to tell them how grateful I am.
You should.
It's so rare.
So rare. It's, oh my God. Yet, in fact, it should be the easiest. I did Miami Dolphin football for years, including the perfect season. So I'd do color, and then I would have to interview Don Shula and some of the players after the game. That was the easiest thing in the world. That was easy. And how these interviews, you have seen it. I have just seen it. Ask about what you've seen. On that play there in the third quarter, when the wide receiver appeared wide open, did you talk to the quarterback about that? We both seen it. The dumbest questions are, Odyssey. A lot of times I shut it off. I won't watch sideline reporters ask questions because they are the dumbest of the dumb. When did you think you had it won? Why? Oh, my God. So the good ones deserve your praise. I used to say, I could go into a locker room, and for 5 minutes, I don't have to know the sport, and I don't have to know if the team won or lost. Example, I'm in the locker room. Football, baseball, basketball, hockey. What surprised you today, coach? Did you have anything in the game plan that went wrong? Can you learn from this game today and apply it to the next game? Still don't know what you played. Still don't know if you won or lost. They're all good questions.
Do you think that you do your job differently now than you did 20 years ago?
No. I think you could play my tape with Bobby Darin and probably maybe just forming a thing, but it would be good. Haven't heard it, but I'm sure it would be good because I've had the same curiosity and I love broadcasting and I appreciate the microphone, appreciate the camera. I have great respect for it. I don't own it. Somebody else owned, Ted Turner owned the cameras. The Mutual Broadcasting System owned the microphones. NPR may own these microphones. I don't know them. You don't own them.
If you are still the same amount of good that you were 55 years ago, have you not learned anything about how to be better over the course of that time?
Well, be better. I'm always engrossed in the guest. I'm always listening to the answer. I'm always learning. So I guess I'm better every day at learning. The one thing that slows you down is sometimes memory slows you down. You'll forget a word and you'll have to find a substitute word right away, you know. Like it dismembered and you'll say came apart. Couldn't remember dismembered. You know? But you think quickly and you react as fast as you can, but your memory does slow down. Aging. But I don't have a problem with open reads, teleprompters. I've been fortunate. I'm very fortunate in my livelihood. Still pretty good. You know, Sinatra said something to me that's so true. There's a lot to be said for longevity. If you're around a long time, you're doing something right. You must be doing something right. That the public still likes you, they recognize you. They appreciate what you do. And you can't be liked by everyone. That's a big mistake. People who want to be liked by everyone would be wind up being liked by no one. And when I speak at colleges or talk to students, don't imitate people. Be yourself. That's the best advice you can give anyone. Be yourself. Never have to worry.
Do you enjoy resting?
Mm-hmm. I didn't used to. But now I enjoy a little half-hour afternoon nap. I still enjoy my sports events, my movies, theater. I don't like long-distance travel anymore. I have to do it. I've got a speech coming in Norway, and London.
I mean, you don't really have to do it, do you?
No, but I enjoy the breakaway to be in front of a crowd.
Right.
So I put up with the trip. I wish I could materialize. And some I do by satellite. And that's fun, too. But I enjoy, the best thing about making people laugh is you walk onto a cold stage. There's no prop. There's no guest. Nothing to work off. Make them laugh. Make them laugh. Just sitting there, okay, make me laugh. That's pretty tough. But if you got a store of material and you're confident in yourself, you can work right off it.
It's interesting to me that you have these two great pleasures in life, or at least in your work life. One of them is the absolute maximum amount of deference that you could possibly have as a public figure, which is just asking people dumb questions, right? Opening your heart and saying, like, what's it like?
You but know, that's not have, dumb.
What's it? But I'm using dumb advisedly here.
The secret is being dumb.
Let's call them basic
help me
questions, sure. The other thing is the most performative. Walking on stage by yourself with a microphone and getting laughs, and I know this, I have many friends who are, as I'm sure you do, many friends who are comics and have interviewed many comics and have done comedy myself, that is the most about getting a result. Like you're,
oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, you know it. In other words, you could be in a drama, in a play, you don't know how well you're doing. I mean, the audience is still, you could feel it, but you don't really know. Comic knows. Singer doesn't know. Band leader doesn't know. Comic knows. A comic knows. They're laughing or they're not. There's no excuse. I don't blame an audience. But if you've been doing it a while and you got what you call, as Alan King used to say, tried and true material. If I know a joke is funny or a story is funny and I can tell it well, and that's the thing, that's Pagliacci. I'm feeling bad. Something terrible just happened at home. My wife is screaming at me. I go on that stage. I got to put that all away and pretend. It is pretending, but still, to have that delivery, to make them laugh, and then they make you happy. You're having as good a time as the audience, making them laugh. That moment before you deliver a punchline, and they're waiting for it. That moment before a joke ends or a story ends, that's the biggest high of all. That's bigger than any interviewing high for me. That's the biggest high of all. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. No, any comic will tell you that. It's the height of fulfillment. It's love. If they're laughing, they love you. They don't fake laughter. You can't fake it. I'm either funny or I'm not. And that's what I like about it, because it's a chance. I could be funny in interviews if it's a comic and Mel Brooks and I'm playing off him. But most of my interviews are not funny. So I get the chance when I do that to be funny.
Is it different for you now that you are older than almost everyone you interview? I mean, Mel Brooks
person.
Might have a year or two on you.
He's got 7 years.
I'm glad you're counting.
But he's still funny as hell.
I interviewed him, and he is real funny still.
There's nobody funny.
Sharp as a tack.
Nobody funnier than Mel. He's the funniest man on earth. Challenge any comic to go head-to-head with him.
I'm not gonna take that challenge.
Lenny Bruce very well, and George Carlin, and Gleason and Hope, and Woody Allen is a genius, but nobody like Mel.
Okay, so
I would play games.
I will stipulate Mel Brooks is the funniest. Can't tell me otherwise.
Me either.
However, the question originally was not is Mel Brooks the funniest, but rather is it different for you now that you're older than almost all of your guests?
Different is I know I'm 83. 80. Goddamn three. My father died at 46. Whenever I got to be 46, I used to think I would die. At 53, I had a heart attack. 6 months later, I had quintuple bypass. I've had type 2 diabetes. I've had prostate cancer. I have good medicine, good doctors. I take care of myself. But I've way out. I'll tell you, so this is really weird. I have one insurance policy where I've already paid more than the face value of the policy. I outbet the insurance company. They won. When you take out insurance, you're betting you're going to die. They're betting you're going to live, and they have the actuary. They've got the figures. Now, how I got this policy, after a heart attack and heart surgery, for $2 million it was. I've had other policies before that, and I already paid it in 20 years. No, 30 years. 30 years. I had the heart attack 30 years ago. I've already paid the $2
million. Do you feel like you've had, I was thinking before about the extent to which your greatest successes came in middle age, that you were a perfectly successful broadcaster, you know.
In Miami, relatively.
Yeah, and the change in your life came around that time that you just described, the time that you passed your father's, the age that your father died, and the time that you had a heart attack that nearly killed you.
I joined CNN in 85, had the heart attack in 87. Yeah, CNN is when I really blossomed because it was television, it was worldwide. Yeah, and I read the obits every day. And my biggest fear is death. I guess I'm an atheist, agnostic. I don't believe in an afterlife. And since I can't believe in an afterlife, I don't want to die. Someone asked me the other day, what do you want your obit to read? I read obituaries every day. Today there was 283s, an 81, an 87, and a 71. I see the ages right away. And I wanted my obit should read, oldest man who ever lived. Passed away today. He was shot in the head and died immediately by an angry husband as he was sleeping with the former playmate of the year. He was 136 years old. It took 3 days to wipe the smile off his face. You know where I don't want to go? Not exist.
I've had this conversation with my wife, who I love very much. And I think I'm probably an atheist. She's at best an agnostic. And I'm terrified of death, as you are. And she's like, well, you know, it was fine when I wasn't alive before I was born.
So what?
So it'll be fine after I die. I cannot buy into it. Like, as much as I want so badly feel that, it's very sincere, but I want it so bad, and I don't think I'm ever going to get there.
My wife is very religious, and believe she's going somewhere.
Your wife's a Mormon, right?
Yeah. So they believe they're going somewhere. And so she's going to see me after I die. Now, I can't believe that. And what bugs me about it is she's going to handle the death pretty well because she knows she's going to see me again while I want her to think about suicide. I want people to grieve. if I die, there is some spirit afterward. I'd love to see what's going on because what I am is curious. And so if I died, will Trump finish 4 years? Will the Dodgers finally win a World Series since 1988?
Hope not.
Who are you?
I'm a Giants fan.
Giants?
I'm from San Francisco.
Giants?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not demanding another one for the Giants. We got three. I'm happy.
Bochy. I like the guys on the team, but I'm a Dodger fan. Now my kids, who are both ball players, excellent ball players, they hate the Giants. They've been on the field with the Dodgers growing up. They grew up with the Dodgers and know all the players. And I went to a Dodger-Giants series in San Francisco, and I took Chance, who's now 18, but then he was 12. We walked from the outfield to the Dodger dugout, which is on the first base side. Walked by a Giants dugout, and I know a lot of the Giants. Bruce Bochy and catcher. I stopped to talk to them. He didn't want to talk to them. I said, Chance, shake hands.
Buster Posey standing in front of you. National League MVP.
He goes like this. Yeah, hi, nice meeting you. He's the enemy, which was what Bob Gibson used to tell me all the time. They are the enemy. he didn't agree with talking to players before the game on the other team. Didn't like all-star games because you have to play with people you're playing against.
I mean, I understand it. I don't like the Angels just because Mike Socha is their manager. It's completely unreasonable. I mean, I'm sure he's a perfectly decent human being.
Baseball is the most personal of all sport, but Red Barber, the great announcer, he used to say some great things. Remember, why the pitcher and the batter hate each other. That batter would like to deprive that pitcher of a living. The pitcher would like to see that that batter is sent down by my accomplishments, striking him out. On the opening day of the season, Red used to say, "Today they play in anger." I love that line.
What's the worst mistake you made in your career?
Smoking. Not career, was before I started. 17 years old, I picked up a cigarette and liked it. My father had smoked, and he was 46 and died when I was 9 and a half. At the height, I was smoking 3 packs a day, and then I had a heart attack, never smoked again. Never wanted one. 30 years. February. But if I could have that day back, I'd have that day back.
What about on mic or in a meeting?
Well, everyone's done stupid little things. Introducing a football game, out on the field comes the drug and bugle corps. When I was just starting, a priest came into the restaurant. I was so awkward and just starting. Asked him how many children he had. Now you could ask that. But I've never been called into the manager's office. I've never cursed on the air. My career has been pretty good. Not good off the air. I've had many wives. I'm a good father. I've had a life of accomplishment. This room we're sitting in with all these trophies and stuff. I go into this room for an ego build.
Yeah, I feel like some of these trophies at this point might be load-bearing.
And John Kennedy Jr. and trophies and a personal handwritten letter from Gerald Ford. Ted Turner and I signed the first $1 million contract there. But these are all reminding me of my past. And people come in this room and they're very impressed. And it makes me feel good. Now, obviously, you have a sense of accomplishment. You try in your life. All I wanted to do was be on the radio. If my father could see this, if he could see what I've made in my life, I don't make it now, but what I made then would be unbelievable to him. I don't think he made $4,000 a year. And I never did it for money. Money was a byproduct of what I do. It happened to be a profession that pays well if you're successful. But I didn't choose it for that reason. I just wanted to communicate.
Well, Mr. K, I'm so grateful that you took all this time to talk to me.
My pleasure, Jesse. I got to go to lunch.
It's a real honor.
And I'm wondering, what will I have? See, if I died on the way there, I'd never know. To not exist? I think I want to be frozen. Frozen is the one hope that you might come back.
That was Larry King. These days, you can catch him on his internet show, Larry King Now, where he's still going strong after 60 years, interviewing absolutely incredible people. It's available on Aura TV and on Hulu. You've been listening to The Turnaround. If you like this show, tell a friend, subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, share one of our interviews on social media, send somebody an email to tell them that you liked it. Send someone a handwritten note, like a perfumed handwritten note that says they should listen to this interview podcast where an interviewer interviews interviewers about interviews. Maybe they'll subscribe. That's our whole marketing budget, folks. You can always visit MaximumFun.org to listen to our shows or grab them in your favorite podcatcher. There are also text versions of our interviews on the Columbia Journalism Review's website at CJR.org. They've got edited transcripts of everything for easy sharing. CJR is a co-presenter of this show. Their mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Amazing organization. They do amazing work. You can find it all at CJR.org, including their podcast, which is called The Kicker. All of the Turnaround's music is provided to us by Mobius Van Chockstraw. You can check him out at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer here at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director, Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost for making this show a reality. We'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.